Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, join us in Galway's Town Hall Theatre on Saturday, 6th of April, Killarney's INEC on Saturday, the 13th of April, and in Belfast's Waterfront Studios on Saturday, the 27th of April. Tickets from venues or at mcd.ie.
And if you look back on all of those organisations, there was always a number of people who clearly qualify as psychopaths that got mixed in with them. Jonathan Dowden gives him a glowing reference and says Pierce McCauley can sort it all out, and Pierce is going to speak to we, and they speak about a guy, Kevin O'Neill, as well. And Pierce McCauley obviously acts as a kind of fixer, really.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. IRA killer Pierce McCauley lived a life of violence as an IRA volunteer and later as a prison bully and a brutal domestic abuser. Found dead, aged 59, at his home in Strabane in County Tyrone, he leaves behind a legacy of fear and intimidation spanning decades of controversy. One of a four-man team who shot dead Detective Garda Jerry McCabe during a botched post office robbery in 1996, he was given the full support of Sinn Féin as a political prisoner. But when he attacked and stabbed his former wife, Sinn Féin councillor Pauline Tully, he became ostracised from his old supporters. Today, I'm talking with Niall Donald about the life and the legacy of McCauley, the terrorist who went from hero to villain. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. I often wondered about a lot of these IRA men you hear of, and you know, you go through their career and there's so much violence involved, obviously. Different times, they would say they were fighting a war for Ireland. But there's an awful lot of really psychopathic, violent people that were attracted to it. That might sound like something really obvious. Pierce McCauley had violence in him, in his fight for Ireland, but he also had violence in him which had nothing to do with that. He attacked his own wife, stabbed her, and multiple times in a drunken rage or whatever it was, they had split up and he'd gone over to collect his children on a Christmas Eve morning. He shot dead Garda Jerry McCabe, which was part of a robbery, and I don't think was necessary violence.
No, I mean, it's very interesting when you look back on it. I think if you see after the ceasefire, there was obviously a huge amount of people involved in the Provisional IRA. You know, of course, not all these people were psychopaths, you know, and once the peace process began, a large number of them, possibly even the majority of them, returned to something like a normal life. Despite everything that they had gone through. However, there was also a significant number of people who could not stop being violent, I suppose. And Pierce McCauley would have been one of the most high-profile examples. He was a very high-profile IRA man, really from the 1990s. He probably in 1991 he escaped from Brixton Prison in the UK after somebody had sent him a gun in the post, and he managed to break out
in a shoe,
yeah, which is incredible when you think back.
What did he post a shoe for?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it got a gun into him.
One shoe,
I think. A gun hidden in the sole of it.
Right.
And, you know, so if you're talking about somebody at that sort of high level risk taking, he was already in prison, obviously, for an attempted murder attempt. And then he arrived back in Ireland. And at this point, obviously, the IRA campaign was beginning to wind down, I suppose. And in particular, at that point, the Provisionals had largely ceased operations in the south of a type. So during the 80s and the 70s, the Provisional IRA had carried out a large number of bank robberies. They'd also carried out kidnappings, for example, Ben Dunn, where Ben Dunn was kidnapped and a ransom was demanded. But it did, at the stage in 1996, when Gerry McCabe was shot, they'd really tried to not do these things publicly at the very least. They were on the road, the Provisional movement, towards being a political road, really. So the shooting of Gerry McCabe, as you said, it became one of these really complex things where, is this an unofficial IRA operation or an official IRA operation? You know, ignoring the fact that all IRA operations were, in theory, unofficial. You know, but obviously Gerry McCabe was shot dead, and it was one of those killings in Irish history that had a huge, huge impact.
It's the same year, of course, that Veronica Guerin was killed just some months previous. And there was an effort to charge the four with murder.
Yeah.
But due to witness intimidation, they were convicted of manslaughter in the Special Criminal Court. But what I wanted to kind of try and delve into a little bit before we go into the nuts and bolts of what he's done is, you know, you have an individual like Macaulay. He's attracted to the IRA.
Yeah.
They're attracted to him.
Yeah.
Because they don't really want, you know, at a time of war, they want people who are capable of violence and of carrying out, you know, wartime, they will call it atrocities, though.
Yeah.
Nonetheless. The people you're talking about that walked away from the IRA in the aftermath of the peace process would say that that's what they fought for.
Yeah.
And they really were, to my mind, proper soldiers, you know, of whatever it is, whether you don't have to agree with what they did or what they didn't do, but they were fighting for equal rights. They were fighting for an Ireland where Catholics and nationalists had a, you know, equal position, and where they were being ruled by an outside country, Britain, and they were being treated like shit in the end of the day. They were up in the north. And you speak to those IRA guys, and they are very deep thinkers. They're very political, intelligent people. And they thought what they did and what they sacrificed was for their grandchildren and their children to grow up in a totally different environment, a better place than where they did. But then you have this whole raft of extremely violent, essentially in a different environment, they would have just been criminals.
Yeah.
They were attracted to the IRA because it gave them weapons, it gave them something to do. But, and in a way, is it similar to, you know, the Catholic Church wasn't in place to attract paedophiles, but it bloody well did because of its setup and because of the power it gave adults over children and because of what it was.
Yeah, it's a very complicated mix, I think. I mean, political ideology was there, and that was driving people to some extent. But there's no doubt there's people in all societies that have a capacity for violence. And if there is an outlet given to them, whether it be even sort of state-sponsored violence you see in other countries where you have people joining armies and committing acts of violence, there's no doubt that the terrorist organizations in the north gave some of these people an opportunity to commit violence. And if you look back on all of those organizations, there was always a number of people who clearly qualify as psychopaths that got mixed in with them. If you look at, say, the Shankill butchers involved in the UVF up the north, I mean, these people were cold, clear psychopaths. There was a number of people.
Steak knife.
Yeah, there's Steak Knife in the IRA, and then Steak Knife in the British, you know, his role in the British Army. But that also followed through. There were some exceptionally violent people involved in the INLA, and it's very hard to look at them and say they were driven by socialist Republican ideology. Pierce McCauley, you know, maybe the test of the pudding is in the eating. I mean, after he was his, if you remember, he was imprisoned for the death of Jerry McCabe. And then it became a big political issue whether the killers of Jerry McCabe were entitled to be released under the Good Friday Agreement like the rest of the IRA prisoners.
And both he, Michael O'Neill, Jeremiah Sheehy and Kevin Walsh, who were his co-accused and convicted, were all given massive backing from Sinn Féin.
They were given massive backing for Sinn Féin. The government didn't want to let them out, saying these were a different case. Ultimately, they were released. The Sinn Féin continued to campaign to say these were no different than anybody else who had been involved in the conflict, that you can't, I suppose, let killers out up the north and say that was part of the Troubles and these guys are different because it was a guard that killed in a different circumstance. So, I mean, when he was ultimately released, he was, of course, met by Martin Ferris, who was a Sinn Féin TD.
Now, that was 6 years after he was granted special release to marry a Sinn Féin councillor called Pauline Tully, who had been into prison on some, I can't remember exactly what it was, but she had met him in Castlereagh prison where he and his other co-accused were living in houses on the grounds. You know, they were given that special dispensation within the criminal justice system. But she had met him in prison. They had fallen in love or whatever, and she'd married him while he was in prison.
Yeah.
Now, a Sinn Féin councillor, and I have to say, when the court case came up, I did speak to her briefly. We'll get on to that. But a very gentle sort of a woman.
Articulate, yeah.
Really, really lovely natured woman.
Yeah.
Really, really, I'd say, you know, all full of good intentions, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's easy to look back and think, you know, who did you think you were marrying?
Yeah.
You know, did you think you were marrying a man who had fought a cause for Ireland and not a violent man? But clearly she did. She married him in 2003, and in 2009 is when you're talking about Martin Ferris showed up, collected him from prison. And basically the British government abandoned their plans to extradite him back to the UK. And he fell into a marriage with Pauline Tully. They had had children, or certainly have children together. So that marriage didn't work out.
No, because, you know, Pierce McCauley did not become, a productive member of society. Let's put it that way. And there were signs of that, even in the prison system. He did not have a reputation, as some IRA prisoners became academics, wrote books and plays. Pierce McCauley was not of that type. We always heard that he was somebody who threw his weight around within the prison system. When he got out of prison, he was a very, very heavy drinker. He was certainly somebody who was in and out of the pubs, shooting his mouth off, all of that sort of stuff. And obviously,
threw his weight around at home.
Obviously we found that, you know, when it did come to court, you heard, I mean, it wasn't, not that any level of domestic violence is acceptable, but he literally could have killed that woman.
It was terrifying. It was absolutely one of the most terrifying cases I think I've heard.
Yeah.
You know, and I have been to a lot of cases.
Yeah.
But the detail of it was just, you know, he was supposed to come on the Christmas Eve 2014 to collect the kids, still had access to the kids and they were sharing the parenting of them or whatever. And he showed up instead 2 hours earlier, absolutely pissed.
Yeah.
and started to attack his ex-wife at that stage. I think he punched her in the face as soon as she opened the door, got her into the kitchen, and with a knife stabbed her 13 times and left her for dead. She had to, there was then, I think she managed to get out and call her brother, or some neighbor called her brother, who basically came over to find him. He had her pinned into a car. She had sought refuge in a car. He was still trying to go at her again. And I think her brother managed to overcome him before the police called. But he not only tried to kill her, but he tried to do that in front of their children. And she later spoke about how one of her sons had seen through a window in the kitchen, or through a door in the kitchen, him actually physically plunging a knife into her abdomen. And she said at the time, and in the aftermath of that court case, that she was never going to not live in fear again for the rest of her life. This animal sort of emerged from the man she had married. I don't believe that was the first time he had shown violence or certainly threatened her, but that was the kind of culmination of a marriage that didn't work out. So McCauley was sent away for, what was that? Was it 14 years he got that
something
time?
Something like that, yeah.
It was a hefty sentence, hefty like. Sentence,
yeah, because, so then he went back into Castlereagh ultimately. He wasn't at this point being housed with dissident Republicans for the most part. He wasn't put in, for example, Portlaoise prison for a lengthy period of time. But again, once he got into Castlereagh, he was throwing his weight around. He also became, I mean, he was charged with drug dealing, I think, while in the prison, which is, you know, obviously the Provisional IRA, which he had been a leading member of, really looked down on any drug dealing. So I think he was charged in relation to relatively minor amount of prescription drugs, but he certainly remained involved even in prison in a certain amount of criminality. I suppose during this time, we found out much, much later, of course, that he was getting a regular visit from another now disreputable character, I suppose, Jonathan Dowdall.
Mm. Came out, of course, during the Regency Hotel trial.
Came out during the Regency Hotel trial. So, I mean, Piers McCauley ultimately got released.
But Dowdall, just to go back to that for a minute before we go on, Dowdall was visiting McCauley. I think he'd visited him 14 times. He admitted to under cross-examination to having seen him once or twice. But basically, when you I mean, we were there listening to the evidence of what happened that day in the Regency, but also the aftermath of the sort of the Hutch organized crime group, as the state were saying, trying to get rid of those Kalashnikov weapons and the AK-47s rather, and get them up to the north as a kind of a piecemeal offering to dissidents who they wanted to step in and stop the feud between the Kinahan and the Hutch organization, step in as peace brokers. It was all very extraordinary evidence to listen to, very interesting to listen to how, you know, the two sides of that feud saw the role of the distance, saw the power of the distance. Clearly the Hutch organized crime group, or Dowdall representing them, believed they had the power to tell Daniel Kinahan to back it up. Kinahan certainly wasn't in any way, shape or form going to meet them. But Dowdall was, like, McCauley emerged from all that story and all those people that were met, and Hutch himself, Jerry Hutch, was brought up to meet the real IRA, our new IRA, real IRA.
Yeah,
Jerry,
what's
his name again? Mellon?
Thomas Ash Mellon. So, I mean, you could see,
and others in the darkness of the night.
Yeah, so I mean, it was actually ahead of the Regency Hotel, Jonathan Dowdall's, I think it was in January, the Regency occurred in February 2016.
Pre and après, yes.
Yeah, so Jonathan Dowdall had gone up, according to Jonathan Dowdall, so you have to take everything with a pinch of salt. He'd spoken to Piers McCauley about attempting to resolve the growing Hutch-Kinahan feud. Whether that occurred or not, we'll never know. Then he said, in the aftermath, then he arranged a meeting. He got Piers McCauley to make a call. And Jonathan Dowdall can be heard talking. Obviously, Jerry Hutch's conversation with Jonathan Dowdall in the car were bugged. And they're heard talking about Piers McCauley. And Jonathan Dowdall gives him a glowing reference and says Piers McCauley can sort it all out. And Piers is going to speak to we. And they speak about a guy, Kevin O'Neill, as well. And Piers McCauley obviously acts as a kind of...
A fixer, is he?
A fixer, really.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, of course...
While in prison. I mean, how odd is that?
While in prison for beating up a woman who's a Sinn Féin representative. And he's still acting as a fixer at that point for with these dissident organisations. And it certainly seems to have their ear and their respect. So that shows you, I suppose, that, you know, that network still existed at that point. And Piers McCauley was still somebody that was certainly not regarded as being beyond the pale. He was still regarded as a man that was worthy of respect, that could put these two, in theory, powerful organisations together. And that's...
I don't think Dowdall was a bit embarrassed about having met him.
He was
on a personal level, I thought, as well as kind of, you know, obviously he didn't want to discredit...
Yeah. I mean, he got a terrible time actually over it because he...
Well, he lied.
He lied. So like a lot of Jonathan Dowdall's lies, they were kind of silly lies that were going to be caught out because he insisted he met him maybe twice in prison. He called into him twice. But of course, the defence merely applied...
After denying he knew him at all or visited him at all. It was only when he was hit by Brendan Graham for the defence with the visitor's log.
Yeah, but see, that... Even then, prison. Yeah, even then he'd said, oh, I might have met him.
Twice,
then, yeah. And then it merged, like, again, 14 times.
Yeah.
And, you know, he spoke about his conviction for domestic violence and said, oh, you know, I don't judge people. And
it doesn't really make sense that the dissident's fixer would be in prison because it's a place where, you know, there's, you know, for people who are so paranoid about being listened into and etc. Yeah. How do you do any business?
Well, I don't know if you...
From prison, because obviously the visits are monitored. Well, they're not supposed to be... Well, they are. I mean, they're monitored and
they
all know that they're listening into phone calls and all the rest of it. There is an intelligence gathering network within the prison system, which is very effective. So why would you have your fixer in prison?
Well, I don't think you... Probably a fixer is you know, what probably emerged...
He gave the nod, didn't he, to make... Yeah,
what emerged is that he was a man that was considered worthy of respect in the Republican movement. And rather than being a full-time fixer, getting a wage, that he could still have that role with those dissident organisations, that he could still give his backing to something and it would have to happen.
And of course, the dissident organisations came out of it pretty poorly as well. I mean, the individuals involved and the evidence that we heard from the bug in the car, that they had arrived in this sort of darkened road to meet with Jerry Hutch, drink taken. They were a bit chaotic.
Yeah. It
didn't come across very professional.
No, the mystique of the all-powerful IRA suffered a blow.
It did.
But, you know, exactly. So you just get the impression that there's a bunch of these alphas, probably many of them like Piers McCauley, whose days of being really dangerous people are past them. But nonetheless, that's where he went after he got out. Piers McCauley a couple of years ago, when he got out of Castlereagh, we pictured him getting out and then he went back up
to Strabane.
To Strabane, where he was originally from. Nothing really was heard of him over the last couple of years until it emerged that he died. It's believed he died of natural causes. You know, a pre-existing health issue is being mentioned, though obviously none of that is confirmed by at this point. But that is a sort of a sad and lonely end.
59 years of age, and no doubt his ex-wife Pauline Tully and the family of Jerry McCabe don't feel any great happiness one way or another about his death. But I'm sure for his ex-wife, the idea, you know, if she was going to live in fear for the rest of her days, you know, she can rest easy that he can never come for her again now at this stage.
But it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, what sort of life he would have been if he'd grown up in different political circumstances?
What would he have been? You know what I mean?
What would he have been? And
would he still have been a wife beater? Would he still have been, you know, a violent bully in and out of the prison system? Did the IRA and the violence that he carried out on behalf of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, did that make him a violent man, or was he a violent man drawn to the IRA because of what it allowed him become legitimately?
Well, I would think that's the case. Mm. But like, it's interesting, in this week we have, you know, we can speculate that he might have always gone down that route, but you know, he died within 24 hours, was it, of Rose Dugdale dying?
Yeah.
In South Dublin. Rose Dugdale obviously had been born in the most privileged background you could possibly have in the UK, and had ended up becoming an IRA volunteer and carrying out a number of, you know, very wild criminal conspiracies on behalf of the IRA, including the break-in and the stealing of paintings in Rusborough House. Would she, like, where did politics play a role in her? You know, she, would we say the same, that if this struggle in the north had never occurred, could she have lived a quiet life?
No, I don't think so at all. Sure, she'd been to Cuba and had been interested in various other countries of strife before she kind of landed in Ireland. And,
yeah. But it is interesting, isn't it, that those two people within 24 hours, look, we can't unpick, you know, where politics starts and where people's individual personality begin.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Nicola.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.